Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Bush Social Security Program, these targeted accounts, when we come back. You know, with an income of $50,000, you pay about $7,650 in Social Security taxes if you're self-employed and you're paying the 15.3% rate. Well, then, shouldn't you subtract that $7,650 from your $50,000 income and pay your income tax on the $42,350 balance instead of paying 17% of the $50,000 a second time? But the IRS makes you pay 15.3% of $50,000 in Social Security tax. Then they turn around and make you pay 17% of that same $50,000 in income tax. So what that means is that you're paying 17% of the $7,650 twice. Now, that little bookkeeping trick steals an extra $1,300 from everybody that pays that tax. Now, what would you think if Sears, Penny's, or your credit card company charged you twice, like Social Security and the IRS does? I thought you'd think that was just real special. Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status, the school, is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and then send an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about a neat little book that I'm recommending. It's Is Our Children Learning? That's a quotation from George Bush, President Bush. He's got some real neat lines, and lines that Yogi Berra hasn't thought of yet. Chapter 8 in Paul Begala's book deals with Social Security, and if you'll remember, George Bush has come up with an idea called private accounts. George Bush wants to bail Social Security out of the economic morass that it's in. Now, the Democrats tell us that there is no economic morass, there's no crisis, and there's no problem. And one of the champions of Social Security, Paul Begala, has written a book, Is Our Children Learning? It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $12. I think it's a very humorous book. I think it's well worth the $12. If you're a Democrat, you should memorize this book. If you're an independent, you should read it. And if you're a Republican, you should fear it. That's what James Carville said about it. I don't know that it's necessary to fear it. I'm not a politician, and so I'm not here to promote politics one side or the other, but rather to analyze Social Security from a businessman's point of view and from a biblical or a scriptural point of view, and let's see if there's something we can learn from it. Well, Paul Begala begins Chapter 8 of the book, Is Our Children Learning, by saying that Republicans have always hated Social Security. And George W. Bush has always been a Republican, so I'm more than a tad skeptical when W. talks about wanting to fix Social Security. Kind of reminds me of the vet who fixed my dog, Gus. After the fix was in, that which once worked just fine didn't work no more, and Gus was none too happy about the deal. Well, George W. Bush wants to neuter Social Security, and his plan to cut taxes for the rich by $1.9 trillion, while risking a huge portion of the Social Security Trust Fund in the stock market, could spell the end of Social Security as we know it. Now, do you think I'm being an alarmist? Well, I wish I were. Check out the Houston Chronicle. It says, Bush on Tuesday said that his plan to create private savings accounts could be the first step toward a complete privatization of the Social Security system. Complete privatization of Social Security. Haven't we tried that before? Oh yeah, back in the Depression. Before Roosevelt created Social Security, the retirement system was completely privatized then. You worked, then you retired, and if the money ran out, you were broke. Of course, even then, the system wasn't completely private. There were county poor farms where the destitute could live and work until they died. I remember, if that's too much government involvement for W. Now, to his credit, Bush is being honest about what he wants. He doesn't want to tinker with the system. No, he wants to take the single most successful government program of the 20th century and reinvent it in his image. I might feel better about the whole thing if Bush actually had gone to class when he was enrolled at the Harvard Business School. But at least he's candid when he declares that his proposal to privatize about 16% of Social Security is just the beginning, more like the beginning of the end. As the New York Times reported, answering a question about his plan, Mr. Bush said that the government could not go from one regime to another overnight. He said it's going to take a while to transition to a system where personal savings accounts are the predominant part of the investment cycle. And so, this is a step toward a completely different world and an important step. A completely different world, but what will Bush's brave new world look like? That was an allusion to Aldous Huxley. Well, Bush admitted that it was conceivable that a worker who opted for Bush's privatization scheme could wind up worse off than under the old guaranteed Social Security system. And he was even more blunt in the Dallas Morning News when asked whether he envisions a system in which future beneficiaries would receive no less than they would have under the current system. Mr. Bush said, maybe, maybe not. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe, maybe not. Well, that's not what seniors who want to retire in dignity and security want to hear, Governor. Maybe, maybe not is not an acceptable answer from the weatherman when you ask him if it's going to rain. But it's not an acceptable answer from your heart surgeon either when you want to know if the new transplanted heart is really going to be better than the old heart. And it gets worse. As the New York Times reported, Bush also refused to say how much the benefits might be reduced for workers who created these private investment accounts. That's all up for discussion, Mr. Bush said. So this we know. There's no guarantee under Bush's plan that your benefits won't be cut. There's no guarantee that your investments won't go down. There's no guarantee that if they go down, say if you invest in a company as poorly run as Bush's El Busto Oil Company, that the government will make you whole. A Social Security system without guarantees is like a car without wheels. You can shine it up all you like, but it can't take you where you need to go. Now, one of Bush's hopes to build support for his system is to undermine confidence in the current system. His plan has no guarantees, so he pretends that the current system doesn't either, declaring, first of all, there's no guarantees in Social Security today. There are no guarantees. Well, of course there are. The full faith and credit of the United States of America stands behind the government-run, government-guaranteed Social Security benefits. Bush can't name a single time in seven decades when the government failed to deliver on that guarantee. And he wants to pretend it isn't there now, since there truly are no guarantees in his plan. And if the benefits are not guaranteed, the risks are. The stock market is inherently risky, and that's why it often yields greater rewards. But Bush tries to hide the ugly reality that markets can go down. And he simply refused to answer Sam Donaldson's question about what he would do for someone who lost their Social Security investment in the stock market. Listen to this exchange between Bush and Donaldson. Donaldson. All I'm asking is whether you think the government should make good any losses for retirees from their private accounts. Bush, there will be a lot of discussions about the particulars of the plans. Donaldson, well, what do you think? Bush, well, one of the things that's most important is to understand that giving younger workers the option to manage some of their money in safe vehicles is going to be a heck of a lot better rate of return on monies invested than the current system. Donaldson, but Governor, your opponent says it's not safe. Bush, you cannot justify the current. My opponent says a lot of things, but you can't justify the current system. Donaldson, but I want you to answer the question, sir. You're dodging the question. Bush, I'm not dodging the question. Donaldson, all right, I'll state the question again. Should the government guarantee against losses in individual retirement accounts? Bush, but Sam, there are no guarantees today. Donaldson, so the answer is no. Bush, there are no guarantees in the system today, and if you think there are, then I'd like for you to review the voting record of my opponent. Boo. I'll say this for Sam Donaldson. He did his damnedest, but trying to get Bush to admit that his plan for Social Security has no real security is like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. Of course, the good governor is full of beans when he says Al Gore's voting record proves there are no guarantees. What he's referring to was the 1993 Clinton-Gore economic package. This package, which subjected a larger percentage of the Social Security income to the wealthiest retirees to taxation. He says that's all. And it only applied to folks whose net worth averaged around $1 million. So by Bush's logic, because Clinton and Gore raised taxes on the rich, Bush should have the right to cut Social Security for the poor. And they say he's dumb. Well, lots of serious people have weighed in on the notion of investing, or of investing Social Security funds in the stock market, and it makes them very nervous. Because rumor has it that stock markets can go down. Now, I realize that hasn't happened since the last time we had a Bush in the White House. But seasoned veterans of Wall Street like Robert Rubin tell me it has happened, and a report from the nonpartisan General Accounting Office noted, caution is warranted in counting on future stock returns in designing Social Security reform. And the report goes on, however, an average over nearly a century obscures the reality that stock returns fluctuate substantially from year to year. And over the past 70 years or so, stock returns were negative in nearly 1 out of 4 years. And there's no guarantee that investing in the stock market, even over 2 or 3 decades, will yield a long-term average return. And what if Bush is wrong? What if the markets do go down? We could be heading for a government bailout that made the Reagan-Bush savings and loan bailout look like fixing a lemonade stand. A report done by Joseph J. Cordes and C. Eugene Struli, for the Urban Institute said that privatization proposals that would allow individuals to keep gains from private accounts in good times, but require the government to maintain a floor in bad times, would encourage individuals to take excessive risk. The consequences of the government would be similar to those when the savings and loan financial sector essentially went bankrupt. Now, to be perfectly fair to W, and I'm nothing if not fair to W, I should note that Bush has refused to say that he will guarantee against losses in the stock market, and the Urban Institute study shows why, and that's why Sam Donaldson had to chase him around the room so unsuccessfully. Bush doesn't want a system in which the rewards of risk-taking are absorbed by the individual, but the risk is covered by the government, or rather, he doesn't want you to have such a deal. It was fine for him. He made $15 million on the stadium deal, in which the taxpayers of Arlington, Texas, put up all the money to build the stadium, but all the profit went to Bush and his partners. When the team was sold, Bush walked away with a cool $15 million, and the people of Arlington, who took the risk, got nothing. Now, this is classic Bush. He wants to abandon you to the vicissitudes of the marketplace, and he's happy to leave you in a sink or swim environment, but his butt has never been on the line. Bush has always had a sugar daddy. Either big money friends trying to suck up to Poppy or the taxpayers of Arlington and see Bush as a businessman. Maybe that's why he's always smirking. He's playing us for suckers. Would Bush make Social Security go el busto? Well, despite what you've heard from the Cassandras in the media, it's a mythological illusion. Karl Rove will explain that to you, Governor. Social Security is in fine shape. Even under the worst case scenario, it's solvent until the year 2037. And that's if we do absolutely nothing to improve it. Al Gore's Social Security plan would pay off the national debt and still make Social Security solvent until at least the year 2050, back in 1983 when we had a real Social Security crisis. The system was just months from insolvency. Today, we are anywhere from 37 to 50 years away from the problem, and chicken littles like George W. Bush are trying to tell you Social Security is collapsing. Bull. Even the dire predictions of insolvency in 2037 are based on economic assumptions that our economy will only grow at half the rate it's been growing for most of the past century. And if that's true, and economic growth slows by 50%, we're going to have a lot more immediate problems than Social Security becoming insolvent in 37 years. Bush wants you to believe Social Security is on the brink of disaster, so you'll think his privatization plan is the only way out. In truth, his privatization plan would actually speed up the date of insolvency by as many as 14 years, according to a study by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. The plan has a trillion-dollar hole in it. Now let us, for argument's sake, assume that Bush is correct. Assume that investing one-sixth of the Social Security Trust Fund, I'm going to underline that, boys and girls, the Social Security Trust Fund, in the stock market is a terrific idea. There's still one little detail, which the economists call the transition costs. Moving our Social Security system from one based on government-guaranteed benefits to one of private risk and return will not be cheap. Let's say you're living from paycheck to paycheck. The money comes in, the landlord gets paid, then one day someone tells you that you've got to pay the whole year's rent in advance. And that's what Bush's proposal is like. Right now, the little box on your paycheck marked FICA goes straight from your paycheck into your grandmother's Social Security check, not to some savings account in Washington with your name on it. Your payments go to current beneficiaries. And when you're a beneficiary, the payment of current workers will go to you. It's not really a savings account. It's an intergenerational transfer payment. Now, I know we're getting a little too technical here for W, but he's already given up reading by now, so let's keep having this grown-up conversation while he channel surfs for reruns on Animal House. So W comes in and says, hold everything. Under his plan, you get to hold back 16% of the Social Security tax that you're currently paying and which currently goes straight to grandma. And then you invest that in the stock market. Does grandma suddenly lose 16% of her benefits? Well, no, that hardly seems fair, but the money's got to come from somewhere or else grandma's going to end up eating Alpo. And it ain't chump change either. According to the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, Bush's privatization plan would cost $900 billion over the first 10 years. These costs occur because the Social Security system must simultaneously pay out current benefits at the same time that privatization drains over 16% of the money coming into the system. When you combine this with the cost of Bush's $1.9 trillion tax cut, and the Bush plan will leave multi-trillion dollar debts as far as the eye can see. Now, how does Bush plan to deal with these trillion-dollar debt deficits, this hole in his Social Security plan? Well, the Associated Press reports Bush hasn't fully accounted for the costs of moving from the current system to his proposed system. And needless to say, this little oversight does not sit well with seniors. Martin Corey is the Director of Federal Affairs for the American Association of Retired Persons, and he frets. With a reduction in the payroll tax, the money has to be made up, or, unfortunately, it leads to difficult trade-offs. That's fancy talk for open up the Alpo, Granny. Now, one way for Bush to plug the hole in his plan is to cut benefits. Bush himself seems open to cutting benefits. As the Wall Street Journal reported, when asked whether a reduction in guaranteed benefits is inevitable to make the shift to personal accounts affordable, Mr. Bush replied, "That's what I call a transition cost." Well, you may call it a transition cost, Governor. The people whose benefits that you're going to cut are going to have a few other words to describe it. In an outburst of candor, Bush's chief economic advisor, Larry Lindsey, admitted that Bush's plan would absolutely cut benefits. Under Bush's plan, Lindsey said, reductions in the guaranteed amounts of benefits that will go to plan participants are absolutely obvious. So I'll say it, according to Newsweek. Bush doesn't exactly stress Lindsey's statement or the fact that if you pick the investment option and do badly, your combined stock and guaranteed benefit would be less than the regular Social Security package. As my kids would say, duh. Now, another way for Bush to plug the hole in his plan is to raise the retirement age. One way that he might deal with the huge cost is to raise the retirement age. Bush admitted as much on Meet the Press. When Tim Russert asked him, would you look at raising the eligibility age for the boomer generation, Bush replied yes. As part of a trade-off or as part of an opportunity for the boomers and the pre-boomers, boomers to be able to manage their own accounts. Great. Raising the retirement age to 70 or 75 may be fine for the trust-funded offspring of the Eastern elite aristocracy, and it may not be a problem for people, and I'm not naming names here, who have never worked a day in their life, folks who have cruised through life on their poppy's name and their family's connections and their cronies' money. But what about a waitress who carries heavy trays every day? Bush wants her to work till she drops. What about farm workers who stoop and sweat in the sun so that yuppie swine like W can have garden fresh salads at the country club? And what about cops who get shot at, or firefighters who breathe toxic fumes, or garbage men who lift hundreds of heavy garbage cans every day? Bush's plan would be especially rough on African Americans, women, and working families. And of course, Bush's entire plan would be harder on African Americans than white folks, since nearly 80% of African American seniors depend entirely on Social Security for their retirement income. The figure is about 60% for white seniors. Since they're more dependent on Social Security, African Americans would be more exposed to the risks of stock market fluctuations. Women would be similarly treated, since women are more likely to rely on Social Security for their primary source of retirement benefits. And it's not just lefty liberals who have sounded the alarm about how women will be hurt by privatization. John Mueller is the senior vice president and chief economist of Lerman Bell Mueller Cannon Incorporated and a former advisor to former Bush cabinet member and Bob Dole running mate Jack Kemp. He testified before the House Social Security Subcommittee that the largest group of losers from privatizing Social Security would be women. And this is true for women in all birth years, all kinds of marital status, all kinds of labor market behavior, and all income levels. Mueller came to that conclusion after conducting a comprehensive study on Social Security privatization for the Center for the Preservation of Social Security and Medicare. Now, here, as a public service, is George W. Bush's real plan for Social Security. Plan A. Invest in market. Ask Poppy's brother and Wall Street insiders for hot tips. 2. If your investment tanks, get bailed out by big money boys. This works better if you're wise enough to choose a father who is president of the United States if you haven't had the foresight to have such a Poppy. See Plan B. Plan B. 1. Invest in the market. 2. If your investment tanks, develop a taste for Alpo. Now, here's what the experts say. By now, your head is likely spinning, and while I care deeply about Social Security, and I spend a great deal of time studying Social Security when I was a senior aide to the president, I don't pretend to be an expert, but here's what a bunch of smart folks who have looked at Bush's plan have to say about it. First, without the details, the Bush plan looks like its numbers don't add up. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Robert Greenstein, said that in the absence of any more detail, it simply looks like the numbers don't add up until he provides more detail on how could he finance a plan like this. Two, Bush could fundamentally alter Social Security without guaranteeing its financial security. The Washington Post says that if Bush's economic assumptions are wrong, which several economists seem to think that they will be, he would fundamentally alter the character of the highly popular program without guaranteeing its financial security. The Post added that several analysts are skeptical that the stock market will do as well in the future as George Bush suggests. And then third, even Bush's advisor acknowledged the Bush plan will deplete the trust fund. Bush's chief economic advisor, Larry Lindsey, acknowledged that Bush's Social Security plan would deplete the cash surplus in a few years. Lindsey said that the Treasury Department would then have to make good on Social Security bonds. Moreover, Lindsey acknowledged the government may need to dip into general revenues, for example, rely on budget surpluses to cover the cost of transitioning to private accounts by 2030. And the bottom line is this: if we adopt Al Gore's plan, you can invest in the stock market to your heart's content without risking your guaranteed benefits. That's why his plan is called Retirement Savings Plus, and the Social Security system will be in the black until 2050. If we do nothing, you'll still have your guaranteed Social Security benefits, and the system will be solvent until 2037. But if we adopt the Bush plan, your guaranteed benefits will be cut, the retirement age might be raised, there's no guarantee that your stock market investments will make up for your cuts, and the system will go broke in 2023. What a deal. Now, there's the liberal viewpoint from Paul Begala in the book called Is Our Children Learning? The Case Against George W. Bush, published by Simon & Schuster. The price is $12. And if you're a conservative, and if you're starting to vomit because you're getting sick, stand by. We'll be back with more when we talk about Social Security invested in private accounts when we come back. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of the network, or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to the website georgegordon.org or call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, there's quite a bit of talk about this thing called Social Security private investments. And over the years, I've done a number of programs on Social Security. If you just go to the archives, you can pick up Social Security and listen to the statistics and the numbers that I've delivered in the past. But remember, this book was written in the year 2000. Now, that was before Bush was elected the first time. And of course, now the second time around, he's getting more serious about reforming or changing the Social Security program. And of course, the first question, I guess, that we need to take up here is Social Security in any kind of trouble? The Democrats tell us that no, there's no crisis and there's no problem and there's no trouble at all. Social Security is fine. Although they do say there's a long-term problem, either in the year 2023, 2037, or 2050, when it's going to be insolvent. So it's not insolvent today, but everybody seems to agree, both Republicans and Democrats, that over the next 20 or 30 or 40 years, it is going to become insolvent. All right, so with that much out of the way, the question arises, well, how do you fix that? How do you solve that problem? Well, as an old-timey businessman, we businessmen have a solution to that. You either have to cut expenses or increase revenue. Is there any other solution to that? And if you know of one, well, why don't you write me an email and tell me, would you? I've been in the business world all my life. I started at age 11, and I don't know of any other solution to a fundamental shortfall in revenue than to either, one, cut expenses, or two, raise revenue, or some combination of the two. So it seemed like to me that one, we have to get more money going into the system, or we have to have less money coming out of it so that the system matches or meets an equilibrium. I think that's kind of fundamental. Has the system ever had an equilibrium? Has it ever been on a sound economic or financial basis? Well, my research of the system from 1935 to the present is that Social Security has never been on a sound financial basis, as evidenced by the fact that the taxes, that is, the contributions into the system have been raised 22 times in 57 years. And the number of people that are now drawing out of the system compared to the number of people that are paying in has consistently gone down from 80 to 1 to 3 to 1 today. Now, that's what we call, in the jargon, a classic Ponzi scheme. And it appears to me that Social Security is indeed a classic Ponzi scheme. And I agree with Paul Begala here that President Bush's solution to the problem has some real problems of and by itself. And that is, how do you rescue, how do you turn around a Ponzi scheme? I have never seen any example in history where a Ponzi scheme has ever been arrested and turned around. Have you? If you know of one, would you let me know? And I'd like to report on it. Now, a guy by the name of Ponzi, who created this Ponzi scheme back in the early 1920s, had a program that worked just exactly like the Social Security system, which is why it's been likened to or called a Ponzi scheme. So here's the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission Ponzi schemes. A Ponzi scheme is a type of illegal pyramid scheme named for Charles Ponzi, who duped thousands of New England residents into investing in a postage stamp speculation scheme back in the early 1920s. Ponzi thought that he could take advantage of the differences between U.S. and foreign currencies used to buy and sell international mail coupons. Ponzi told investors that he could provide a 40% return in just 90 days compared with a 5% return for bank savings accounts. Ponzi was deluged with funds from investors, taking in $1 million during one three-hour period. And this was in 1921, when $1 million was a lot of money. Now, a few early investors were indeed paid off to make the scheme look legitimate. An investigation found that Ponzi had only purchased about $30 worth of the international mail coupons. Decades later, the Ponzi scheme continues to work on the Rob Peter to pay Paul principle, as money from new investors is used to pay off earlier investors until the whole scheme collapses. For more information, just read our search key topic on pyramid schemes. Now, Dick Armey was on Charlie Rose, I think it was, or Lair, one or the other. And he said that in the year 2018, now that's just, 13 years from now, he said Social Security will be out of money, which is the same position that it was in 1983 when they raised the rates the last time. And Ted Kennedy was on Charlie Rose the other night, and he said, this Bush plan over here is crazy nonsense. And he said, the system, if you do absolutely nothing to it, will have money in it until the year 2037. Now, Ted Kennedy said, and even then the system won't be broke. Here's Kennedy's reasoning. He said, it'll still have 75% of the amount of proceeds that it needs to pay the Social Security recipients. Now, as an old-timey businessman, my understanding of bankruptcy or insolvency is when you can't meet your current obligations. Now, maybe there's a new definition coming up, but that's always been my understanding of it. And let's take this a step further. If, in fact, Kennedy is correct, and in the year 2037, the system is only taking in 75% of the amount of money that it's paying out. Well, if you gave 75% to those recipients in the year 2037 because there's not enough money in the system, wouldn't that be a 25% benefit cut? So whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, everybody seems to be in agreement that at some point in time, whether it's 2023, 2037, or 2050, there are going to be benefit cuts if you do absolutely nothing. Now, isn't that the conclusion that we can all come to and all agree on? So it would look like to me then that if there's going to be this shortfall out here in the year 2037 or at some indefinite time in the future, the people who are paying into the system now, in what we call this pay-as-you-go system, the money that you're paying in today is not going into any trust fund. It goes right into the general fund and right into your granny's Social Security check. And then you're in hopes in the year 2037 that there's going to be your children or somebody else's children paying directly in to your Social Security check. But you're not going to get all of your benefits that are now promised under the current law. You're going to get 75%. So you're going to be paying in today to make sure granny gets 100% of her benefits. But in the year 2037, you're not going to get all of your benefits. You're going to get 75% of them. That sounds like a benefit cut to me. And as far as I can tell, everybody's in agreement. Paul Begala, Ted Kennedy, Dick Armey, George Bush, everybody seems to be in agreement. Furthermore, I understood President Clinton to say about 1999 that Social Security needed to be fixed. That's right. That was Bill Clinton. He said, there's a problem here, needs to be fixed. So it appears to me that everybody's in agreement that there's a problem long term that needs to be fixed. As I understood George Bush the other day, he said, the sooner we get at it, the better, because this shortfall amounts to $1.5 trillion a year. So if we wait 10 years, then it's going to cost us an extra $15 trillion. And if we do it this year, then we'll save that $15 trillion. Well, now I'm an old-timey businessman, and I can relate to that. Let's suppose that you've got a process going on in your manufacturing plant. And in this manufacturing process, you're cutting boards. And somebody comes into your office and says, because of a faulty saw and measuring device, we're losing about 10% of the amount of lumber that could be utilized in our manufacturing process, but it's going out as waste right now. Now, if we were using, you know, let's just say 10,000 board feet a day and we were losing 10%, we'd be losing 1,000 board feet a day. Now, let's assume that lumber is selling for $600 a thousand, so we're losing $600 a day. And somebody says, now it's going to cost about $10,000 to fix this problem. So we have to decide on, do we want to spend the $10,000 to save this $600 a day? Well, right away, that adds up. You know, if you took 10,000, let's just do that, 10,000 divided by 600, that's 16 days. You know, if we invested $10,000 today, why, we would save that $10,000 in that wasted lumber in just 16 days, about half a month. But if we don't do anything for 16 days, it's going to cost us $10,000 worth of lost lumber. And then the next 16 days will be another $10,000, and the next 16 days another $10,000. So, you know, the sooner you fix this thing, the better, isn't it? So I have to agree with President Bush that if you're going to solve the Social Security problem, whether it's by private accounts or whether it's by raising taxes or a combination of the two or some third, fourth, fifth, or sixth answer, it would seem like to me getting after it as soon as possible would be the best economic solution for everybody concerned. Now, that's just the wit and wisdom of an old country farmer, an old businessman, been around for a while, and that's what we would do if we were in the business world. I'm pretty sure that that's what General Motors would do, or Ford, or IBM, or anybody else. And I think that that would be wise if the government did that. All right. Now, a Ponzi scheme is an uneconomical program. It's a program that the numbers don't add up. I'm not sure that very many people understand what a Ponzi scheme is. So I'd like to start with Charles Ponzi, Double Your Money in 90 Days, because Social Security is, in fact, a Ponzi scheme, and I don't think that you can fix a Ponzi scheme. So when George Bush says we're going to fix Social Security, I think he's being disingenuous. I don't think he's telling us the whole story. Now, it may well be that it can be fixed, and George Gordon just doesn't know how to do it. I'd concede that. And I haven't seen President Bush's proposals in detail, as Mr. Bogala says. He just can't imagine how this is going to work. Well, I'm not here to tell you that George Bush can't do it. I'm just here to say I haven't seen it yet. But I thought I'd share the Ponzi story with you. Now, here's what a Ponzi scheme is. Let's learn from Charles Ponzi. He's the originator of it. And let's analyze that a little further and see, are we involved in a Ponzi scheme, and can Ponzi schemes ever be fixed? Now, they're clearly illegal. If Elliot Spitzer were to catch you doing a Ponzi scheme with bottles of whiskey or something, you know, like we used to do when I was a kid, I think he'd shut you right down. You see, these elitists, they want to protect you from yourself. That's why you have Social Security, because you're not smart enough to take care of your own old age. You can't handle that. And so some guy with a PhD comes along and says, we need to use the police power of the state to force you to do this. For the benefit of Granny, of course, and for you over the long haul. And I'm sitting here saying, well, if it was me, I wouldn't make Ponzi schemes illegal. I think fools and their money should be parted. Fools and their money should be parted. I remember I did a Ponzi scheme one time. Guy said, here, sign your name at the bottom of this letter, and you buy a bottle of whiskey and send to this guy and this guy and the next guy over here. And so the scheme called for me to buy five bottles of whiskey and send out five letters to these five guys. Sign my letter, my name at the bottom of one, and I get 25 bottles of whiskey back. So I bought the five bottles of whiskey, I sent them out, signed my name at the bottom of the letter, and I never got a single bottle of whiskey back. I learned the most valuable lesson of my life concerning Ponzi schemes or pyramid schemes when I was about 18, 19, 20 years old. All right, now here's Ponzi. Have I got a deal for you? I can double your money in just 90 days, guaranteed. You say, nonsense. What? What? You don't trust me? I promise you that it can be done. And a man by the name of Charles Ponzi delivered on such and such a promise back in 1920. Now, I know what you're thinking. This has to be some kind of a scam. Well, I would be lying if I said that it wasn't. So put your money back in the bank and face up to reality. You're not going to get rich this week. But here's how it all got started. Carlo Charles Ponzi was born in Parma, Italy in 1882, and then immigrated to the United States in November of 1903. And over the next 14 years, Ponzi wandered from city to city and from job to job. He worked as a dishwasher, a waiter, a store clerk, and even as an Italian interpreter. In 1917, he settled back into Boston, where he took a job typing and answering foreign mail. And it was here in Boston on that fateful day in August of 1919 that Charles Ponzi discovered the mechanism to make both him and his investors very, very wealthy. Now, at the time, Ponzi was considering issuing an export magazine, He had written a letter about the proposed publication to a gentleman in Spain, and when Ponzi received his reply, the man said, or had included, an international postal reply coupon. Now, the idea behind this enclosure was very simple. Ponzi was to take the coupon to his local post office and exchange it for American postage stamps. He would then use those American stamps to send the magazine to Spain. Ponzi noticed that the postal coupon had been purchased in Spain for 1 cent in American funds. Yet, when he cashed it in, he was able to get 6 American 1 cent stamps. Now just think, if you could do this, you could buy $100 worth of stamps in Spain and then cash them in the United States for $600 worth of stamps in this country. Then cash in or sell the stamps to a third party and you have, well, good old cash. You just can't get this kind of interest in the bank. So Ponzi's mind quickly went into overdrive and devised a clever scheme to capitalize on this idea. He was determined to become a rich man, and his first step was to convert his American money into Italian lira. Ponzi's foreign agents would then use these funds to purchase international postal coupons in countries with weak economies or weak currencies. The stamp coupons were then exchanged back into a favorable foreign currency and then finally back into American funds, and he claimed that his net profit on all of these transactions was in excess of 400%. Now, was he really able to do this? Well, the answer is a definite no. You see, the red tape of dealing with the various postal organizations, coupled with the long delays in transferring currency, ate away at all of Ponzi's imagined profits. And then things got just a bit out of hand. A failed scheme couldn't keep Ponzi from bragging about this great idea. Friends and family members easily understood what he was saying, and they wanted in on the investment. You know, let's face it, if you flash enough money in somebody's face, they're bound to take it. So on December 26, 1919, Ponzi filed an application with the city clerk establishing his business as the Security Exchange Company. He promised 50% interest in 90 days, and the world wanted in on it. Yet he claimed to be able to deliver on his promise in just 45 days. This, of course, translates into being able to double your money in just 90 days. Well, the word spread very quickly about Ponzi's great idea, and within a very few months, the lines outside of his office on his school street address began to grow, and thousands of people purchased Ponzi promissory notes at values ranging from $10,000 to $50,000. The average investment was estimated at $300. Now, that was a big chunk of pocket change back in 1921. Now, you're probably sitting there puzzled. Why would so many people invest in a scheme that didn't work? Well, the real reason was that the early investors did, in fact, see the very 400%, these great returns on their money. Ponzi used the money from later investors to pay off his earlier obligations. It was a new twist on the age-old pyramid scheme. With an estimated income of $1 million a week at the height of the scheme, his newly hired staff couldn't take the money in fast enough. They were literally filling all of the desk drawers, waste paper baskets, and closets in the office with investors' cash. Branch offices opened and copycat schemes popped up all across New England. So that by the summer of 1920, Ponzi had taken in millions and started living the life of a very rich man. Ponzi, dressed in the finest of suits, had dozens of gold-handled canes, showered his wife in fine jewels, and purchased a 20-room Lexington mansion. And then came the crash. Now, any get-rich-quick scheme is certain to attract the attention of the law, and Ponzi was no exception. From the start, federal, state, and local authorities investigated him, and yet no one could pin Ponzi with a single charge of wrongdoing. Ponzi had managed to pay off all of his notes in the promised 45 days, and since everyone was happy to get their earnings, not a single complaint had ever been filed. But on July 26, 1920, Ponzi's house of cards began to collapse. The Boston Post headlined a story on the front page questioning the legitimacy of Ponzi's scheme. Then later that day, the district somehow convinced to suspend taking in new investments until an auditor examined his books. Why anyone who was doing something so highly illegal would let auditors in to examine his books is beyond me, but he did. Within hours, crowds of people lined up outside Ponzi's door demanding to get their investment back. Ponzi obliged and assured the public that his organization was financially stable and that he could meet all of his obligations. He returned the money to those that requested it. By the end of the first day, he had settled nearly 1,000 claims of the panicked crowd. By continuing to meet all of his obligations, the angry masses began to dwindle. The public support swelled again. Crowds followed Ponzi's every move. He was urged by many to enter politics and was hailed as a hero. Loud cheers and applause were coupled with people eager to touch his hand and assure him of their confidence. And Ponzi continued to dream. He had planned to establish a new type of bank where the profits would be split equally between the shareholders and the depositors. He also planned to reopen his company under a new name, the Charles Ponzi Company, whose main purpose was to invest in major industries around the world. Apparently, no one ever told Ponzi that the key to any successful swindle was to take the money and run. Well, the public continued to support him until August 10, 1920. On this date, the auditors, banks, and newspapers declared that Ponzi was definitely bankrupt. 2 days later, Ponzi confessed that he had a criminal record, which just worsened the situation. In 1908, he had served 20 months in a Canadian prison on forgery charges related to a similar high-interest scheme that he had participated in there. This was followed by 1910, by an additional two-year sentence in Atlanta, Georgia, for smuggling five Italians over the Canadian border. On August the 13th, Ponzi was finally arrested by federal authorities and released on $25,000 bond. Just moments later, he was rearrested by Massachusetts authorities and then re-released on an additional $25,000 bond. An estimated 40,000 people had entrusted an estimated $15 million, about $140 million in today's money, in this Ponzi scheme. A final audit of his books concluded that he had taken in enough funds to buy approximately 180 million postal coupons, of which they could only actually confirm the purchase of two of these bonds. Ponzi's only legitimate source of income was $45 that he received as a dividend of five shares of telephone stock. His total assets came to $1.5 million, which didn't come close to paying out the outstanding debt of more than $15 million. Now, that's where Social Security is today. Now, next time, we'll take it up right here. And we'll investigate how Social Security's Ponzi scheme works and how it got started and why it is a pure Ponzi and why it is that it can never be fixed. And that's where I find George Bush to be truly amazing. George Bush says that he's going to fix the Social Security Ponzi scheme. So when people question the intelligence or the veracity of fixing that scheme, I couldn't agree more. And let's see what George Bush comes up with in the months and years ahead, but I've got to leave it right there, so we'll be back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, talking about Social Security and the new private accounts. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. All right, there's the signal. Time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.